I feel very honored indeed to have been invited to give the John Ross Thompson Memorial Lecture, as I remember Mr. John Ross Thompson very well when I was a child, as a loved friend of our family. This title which I have chosen, Investigating the Powers Latent in Man, is not exclusively one concerning New Zealand culture, but it is chosen as a study in the third object of the Theosophical Society. Through the ages, in myth and in legend and historical accounts, there have been told strange stories of occult or unusual faculties or powers exercised by various people. Some of these have given rise to, or have been based on, superstition and fear of the supernatural. Sometimes this phenomena has been used to exploit and gain power over others. Sometimes it has been turned to unselfish ends for healing and the helping of those in need. Witch doctors and sorcerers have appeared amongst primitive peoples, some of them wielding real powers, others exploiting the fear and ignorance of those around them. Faith healers and fortune tellers, some of them genuine and some not, have always been practicing their arts. The Old Testament contains a number of instances of people being able to foretell the future. In the Middle Ages, witches were burned at the stake by those who dreaded or condemned, in the name of religion, any manifestation of supernormal powers. At the same time, the history of Christianity records many so-called miraculous happenings at the hands of Jesus and of various saints. In fact, all the great religions have in their scriptures recorded stories of miraculous events, especially in relation to the founders or leading figures. With the development of modern science, however, particularly in the 19th century, the possibility of psychic faculties or powers not relating to the normal use of the five senses in man became discountenanced as mere mumbo-jumbo. The scientists, armed with various physical laws, began to reduce everything to terms of matter and energy, and it became almost blasphemous to suggest that there might be some other explanation. Human beings were considered as mere physico-chemical automata, and all beliefs relating to the supernatural or paranormal were confined to the intellectual rubbish heap as superstitions and fantasies. The display of certain faculties became relegated to the musical hall and variety show, where acts employing mind-reading and telepathy were performed. Unfortunately, there has been associated with them a good deal of fraud and charlatanism, which naturally brought the genuine exponents into disrepute along with the hoaxes. And so there developed among intellectual people that an attitude that such phenomena, being beyond the realm of scientific knowledge, was mere superstition and not to be taken seriously. These views, unfortunately, still persist today among many people, because to change them would mean a reorientation of the whole scientific view of the nature of man and his personality, would imply the acknowledgement in fact of levels of consciousness and states of awareness in man's nature beyond the ordinary physical and psychological man as he is generally regarded today. Therefore, many otherwise thinking people, including scientists and particularly psychologists, continue to reject out of hand such disturbing conceptions which will upset so many of their acquired conclusions and beliefs. At the same time, There have always been some who have stood out against the wave of iconoclastic materialism, and their stand is now being justified at the bar of science. For there is now emerging so much convincing testimony in favor of certain extrasensory powers in man that they can no longer be ignored. And the time must come before very long when they will be widely accepted as natural phenomena. The study of psychic phenomena and extrasensory powers is not altogether new. The earliest known recorded experiment is described by Herodotus. The experiment was made by Crucius, king of Lydia, who reigned from 560 to 546 BC. He apparently tested the several oracles in Greece at the time, and only one, the Delphic Pythonus, proved satisfactory to him. In ancient Greece too, telepathy was important enough to produce a theory by Democritus as to how it worked. It is suggested that Saul, when he disguised himself before confronting the witch of Endor, was in a sense testing her. At various periods in history, and in proportion to the scientific methods of the time, attempts have been made to examine these things. Porphyry, the Neoplatonist philosopher, became interested in the manifestation of prophecy and other phenomena. We find St. Augustine between the fourth and fifth centuries writing on this subject, particularly miracles of healing. In the 16th century, there were some investigations, and various writings appeared in America and England during and after the Restoration. David Hume and Hegel are among those who have concerned themselves with certain types of phenomena and offered explanations concerning them. Immanuel Kant, in the 18th century, became interested in the experiences of Emanuel Swedenborg, the Swedish mystic, and through an English friend, he began investigations. He has written descriptions of three of Swedenborg's clairvoyants, the most famous one relating to the Stockholm fire, which occurred toward the end of September 1736. Swedenborg was dining at a friend's house at Göteborg, which is quite a distance from the capital, with a party of 15 persons, when he suddenly became alarmed and exclaimed that a dangerous fire had broken out in Södermalm in Stockholm, his own house being in danger. At about 8 p.m., he told the assembled company that the fire had been quenched at the third door from his own house. On the following Tuesday morning, 2 days later, they arrived at the governor's house in Göteborg, a royal courier with an account of the fire which confirmed Swedenborg's statements. There were various works published in the 18th and 19th centuries, but it was not until the last quarter of the last century that serious investigation of psychic phenomena and man's powers became more systematized, when the spiritualistic movement began to make itself felt in the Western world. This movement came at a time when the theories of Charles Darwin were stirring Western thought and bringing a purely materialistic view of evolution and the doctrine of the survival of the fittest to replace the orthodox religious interpretation of the universe and man. By the manifestation of psychic phenomena, it was possible to show that there is much more in the world than meets the eye, and that the survival of the soul was a manifest possibility. Many people began to investigate spiritualistic phenomena, particularly that of the seance room, which involves raps, lights, materialization, and messages being transmitted through mediums, often in a state of trance, with controls supposedly disincarnate entities or other spirits. It was, in fact, through such investigation being undertaken for two New York daily papers that Colonel H.S. Olcott came into touch with Madam H.B. Blavatsky, herself able to create extraordinary phenomena, and they became the principal founders in 1875 of the Theosophical Society. The Society's scope, however, was to be much more than just the investigation of psychic phenomena, though its third object is to investigate unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent in man. When the Society was founded, it was said that it aimed at the study of occult science and esoteric philosophy in theory and practice, and the popularization of the facts throughout the world. Thus there came a rich and deep philosophy based on esoteric knowledge, which not only recognized the existence of extrasensory powers in man, but explained their rationale in terms of evolution of both form and consciousness, and the possibility of their being developed naturally in all mankind as evolution progresses. In 1882, there was formed in London the Society for Psychical Research, which has had a number of scientific and prominent men associated with it, and has published many volumes of proceedings giving data of research done, although not all of it has been completely satisfactory. There have been other bodies also working in other countries in this field. It was a long time, however, before recognized scientific bodies would take any sympathetic view. In 1876, Professor, later Sir William Barrett, attempted to bring some of his experimental work before the British Association for the Advancement of Science, but his paper was met with ridicule. In 1898, Sir William Crookes, who had the unique honor of being in the same year both the president of the Society for Psychical Research and the president for the British Association for the Advancement of Science, he was also a member of the Theosophical Society, declared from the chair at the annual assembly of the British Association at Bristol his convictions concerning the value of the results of scientific investigation into what has been known as the occult. Apparently his words went unheeded, for it was not until 1930, only 27 years ago, that the research concerning extrasensory powers in man actually entered the science laboratory. First of all at the Duke University in the United States of America, and since then it has been taken up by other universities and workers in various parts of the world under the general term of parapsychology. Now, obviously, it is impossible to touch upon all aspects of this vast and fascinating subject in one lecture. Spiritualistic phenomena involving mediumship in its many aspects is not intended as my subject, though, of course, it is within the general field of psychism. I wish to consider particularly evidence concerning extrasensory powers in man, which may be considered as more positive qualities, though not always rightly applied by those who are ignorant of their possible effects upon themselves and upon others. The knowledge that is available to us as the result of both scientific and occult research is not only of profound interest in our study of man, but is of vital application to each one of us in our daily lives. There is a considerable amount of data concerning extrasensory powers available, which is not acceptable by the scientist, because it has not taken place under strictly scientific conditions, and much of it has been spontaneous. In India and other eastern countries, there is ample evidence of the use of various powers by yogis, which are not considered in those countries to be abnormal. All over the world, we are told strange stories relating to premonition of the future, telepathic communication, clairvoyance and clairaudience, which demonstrate the tremendous possibilities of the human personality. They are not accepted, however, as constituting scientific proof, and it is to the more limited and strictly controlled experiments in various universities and elsewhere that we must turn for evidence which, to the unprejudiced, cannot be gainsaid. The most prolonged scientific investigations, as most of you will know, have been those of Dr. J.B. Rhine and his associates at the Duke University in the United States of America. Professor Rhine has published a number of very readable books describing many of his experiments. At first, clairvoyance and telepathy were of equal interest, but very soon, clairvoyance took the lead. For the clairvoyance test, the identification of concealed cards seemed to be the best method, and a special deck of cards was evolved. In his book, The Reach of the Mind, Dr. Ryan says that the highest rate of scoring was accomplished in experiments carried out by Professor B.F. Rice, a psychologist of Hunter College, New York. The exceptional subject was a girl, and in the experiments, the subject and the sender were in separate buildings using synchronized watches. Dr. Rice himself acted as the sender using the standard extrasensory perception cards. The girl scored an average of more than 18 correct hits per 25 in a series of 74 runs through the pack. Once she had a perfect score of 25, and on a number of occasions, it was above 20. Says Dr. Ryan, by the end of the 30s, the case for clairvoyant extrasensory perception was strongly established. By the end of the next decade, we knew that the mind can get reliable effects from matter without sensory intermediation. If the mind can do that, and still in some degree itself be non-physical, then the psychocentric view of man is furnished with strong support. The results suggested then by Dr. Ryan that the cerebrocentric idea of man was only a scientific artifact, he said, and had no true foundation. In other words, Dr. Ryan was suggesting that the mind is different from the brain, and consciousness can exist independently of the organic functions of the material brain. This is a view long postulated by theosophy. It was found from the various experiments that the faculty exercised is quite independent of space, and that distance is of no importance. Sometimes the experiments were conducted with the sender and receiver being hundreds of miles apart, separated by hills, roads, woods, fields, towns, and even the very curve of the earth itself. And yet the results were equally significant, the only factor being the individual's own capacity for such perceptions. Now, the implications arising especially from telepathy experiments, indicating as they do the possibility of one mind to influence another, are of tremendous importance and have significance for each one of us, Since these powers are no doubt being exercised by many people who are not consciously aware of them. Another strange power which has been demonstrated in the science laboratory is that of prophecy or of precognition. There are, of course, many cases where people have had visions or dreams foretelling the future, very often relating to death or an accident to some person. And various collections of these have been published. In the Duke University, the first precognition test was that of trying to predict the order of cards in a deck. The shuffling was done with a machine so that there was no human element involved in, to bring an unconscious influence. The results of these tests and others in America and Britain have strongly supported the case for precognition. This may be very difficult to believe, and yet, as Dr. Ryan says, the very fantastic strangeness of precognition throws into sudden exposure the fragmentary state of our knowledge of the mind and reveals how unprepared we are to receive new facts about our own nature. Another aspect of research was that of psychokinesis, to discover whether the mind can directly influence the motion of material objects, or as it is popularly termed, the power of mind over matter. Apparently it is believed by many people that they can mentally influence dice thrown by the direct use of the will. And when this idea was mentioned at the Duke University by a young member of the gambling profession, the dice-throwing procedure was adopted for a test of this power. The results recorded by a number of researchers, both inside and outside the university, have nearly all confirmed this hypothesis, indicating that the mind or personality has an energy which can affect physical objects and compete with gravity. As Dr. Ryan points out, there can scarcely be any doubt that this power is non-physical. It does not follow the law of mechanics. The possibility of the power of mind over matter is also of importance in the psychological approach to health and disease, and is recognized by psychosomatic medicine today. Other important experiments have been made which are of great interest to us in this study, but time permits mention of only some of them. There is, for instance, the work of Dr. S.G. Searle, who is senior lecturer in pure mathematics at the Queen Mary College in the University of London. He has been experimenting with cards similar to those of Professor Ryan. And the extraordinary result that has emerged was that by far the highest scores were obtained on the card which the agent was going to look at on the next occasion ahead, providing further evidence for precognition. Dr. Searle published a book in conjunction with Frederick Bateman entitled Some Modern Experiments in Telepathy, giving ample evidence in favor of telepathy and describing many experiments carried out in various parts of the world. One extraordinary series took place between a subject, Mrs. Stewart, who was in Antwerp, Belgium, and two agents who were in London. Zero time was taken from the time signal on the BBC Light program, and Mrs. Stewart tuned into that program in Belgium. There were startling results. The odds mathematically calculated against their being due to chance being two millions to one. Another faculty in man which has been explored in various ways is that of psychometry. A person who is a sensitive is able to give various impressions concerning the owner of an object. Dr. J. Hettinger carried out a series of experiments in this field between 1935 and 1937, and published the results in two books, the first of which was approved by the London University as a thesis for the award of the Doctor of Philosophy degree. We can see in what a new light this type of research is now being viewed. Dr. Hettinger obtained significant results and concluded that neither the nature of the object psychometrized, nor the sentimental or emotional association therewith, if any, is the determining factor in the sensitive's response. The actual handling of the articles by the sensitive is not absolutely necessary for the exercise of this faculty. Many of the items concern experiences by the owner after he has parted from the article. Similar conclusions were reached in France by Dr. Eugène Osti, director of the Institut Métaphysique International in Paris. Some particularly interesting research has been conducted in England by Mr. W. Whately Carrington, in which members of the public, with no claims to psychic or sensitive gifts, participated in their own homes, often in different towns. This is a particularly fascinating one. The method used by Carrington was to select a picture as a subject for telepathy at random. He opened a copy of Chambers' Mathematical Tables and noted the last digits of the first three or four entries on the page where he had happened to open the book. Thus, he had a purely chance number. Then he opened Webster's dictionary at the page indicated by this number and selected the first drawable item on the page. Mr. Carrington or his wife then made a drawing of this object, and this was pinned to a bookcase in his study from 7 p.m. to 9:30 the following morning. At any time during this period, percipients in their own homes made sketches, amplified if necessary by written descriptions, of what drifted into their minds as being the target picture. Mr. Carrington has given the results of seven main experiments in which a total of no less than 741 people took part. There have been others involving about 430 percipients. The net result of his experiments shows that a telepathic or extrasensory faculty is clearly in evidence. The whole batch of people together manifest the faculty in a slight degree, some possessing it to a more marked degree than others. His results taken together show that a weak faculty of telepathy, or rather extrasensory perception, is widely, perhaps universally, distributed amongst the population. Not only that, but the results indicated that some percipients had above chance results in describing the target picture which had been exposed the time before, or was to be exposed the time after, this even before it was chosen. This was clear evidence of retrocognition, touching the past, which has appeared in many of the experiments, as well as of precognition. Another faculty which is evident among various people is that of radiesthesia. It is commonly used for water divining, or dowsing as it is called. The art of using a divining rod for finding something hidden is of memorial antiquity and is described by Cicero and Tacitus. The wand of Hermes sometimes is figured as a forked rod. Figures of Mediterranean idols have been found bearing forked rods as symbols of their power, and similar figures have been discovered carved on rocks in Peru. This power of dowsing was used by prospectors for minerals in the German mining districts in the 15th century and was taken to England by the merchant adventurers in Queen Elizabeth's days and used in the Cornish mines. This faculty has been used not only to find water and minerals underground, but also ore, metals, and even dead bodies. In 1692, it was used in France to discover guilty persons in a murder case by the famous dowser Jacques Aymar. Only last month, it was reported in the press in Australia that Brisbane was so short of water that the council's health committee called in a dowser to help find some water for them. He was able to tell them where there are two streams of water, and council engineers are now investigating. This faculty of dowsing is now widely accepted, and is in fact the only aspect of supernormal faculties which has yet been generally recognized as of utilitarian value. Government departments, landowners, and business firms in many countries employ a dowser as a matter of course. Radiesthesia is also used in another way, in the diagnosis of disease, and research along these lines is now being done by the Medical Society for the Study of Radiesthesia in London. A good deal of research has also been done among native peoples in various countries, whose cults include the manifestation of psychic powers. In Australia, for instance, Professor A.P. Elkin, M.A., Professor of Anthropology in the University of Sydney, has recorded in his book, Aboriginal Men of High Degree, the result of some of his studies among Aborigines and the powers displayed by their medicine men. He states that they possess in many cases occult powers. They can commune with the dead, they see spirits fly through the air and do the same themselves, they go up in the sky, they practice telepathy and mass hypnotism, and they gain knowledge by psychical means of what occurs at a distance. Such are the claims and beliefs. Recently, Mr. Ronald Rose and his wife completed a 7-year research on Aboriginal magic in Central Australia, New South Wales and Queensland. And Mr. Rose was reported as saying, extrasensory perception or telepathy is a real thing among Australian natives. There is technical and scientific evidence of it. Mr. and Mrs. Rose have also made investigations of psychic experiences among the New Zealand Maoris and are undertaking now the study of natives in Samoa. Their work is being sponsored by the New York Parapsychology Foundation. This field of research among native peoples is a whole subject on its own. Similarly, the manifestation of supernormal powers among Eastern peoples is a rich field for study, but time does not permit further discussion now. There are other facets of phenomena indicating hidden powers of man, which obviously cannot be included in one study. Students who are interested will find a vast field and fascinating field of research. Furthermore, if we are willing to accept the personal testimony of many hundreds of ordinary people, there are many volumes available in which some of their experiences are described. There are too many and have too authentic a ring to all be products of the imagination. And we can confidently say and believe that these powers, and that there is ample evidence from numerous sources to justify an existence of these powers and the many faculties in man which are not explicable by ordinary physical and psychological conceptions. Our nature and understanding concerning the nature of man must therefore be considerably widened. There is also now enough evidence available to show that the various abilities displayed are not abnormalities. They reveal fundamental properties in man's nature, of which there is some stirring probably occurring in most people. We find, too, that there is a capacity for acquiring knowledge which transcends the ordinary sensory functions. And we can begin to have knowledge not only of objective, but of subjective states transcending the physical. This research has the most revolutionary significance, for we realize that man is more than his body, and his powers are as yet only barely tapped. It is here that the philosophy of theosophy can be so valuable to us in our study of man, for it offers a reasonable explanation of this phenomena and shows that it is not miraculous or abnormal, but is the natural exercise, not always controllable as yet, of man's own inherent faculties. There is a great deal of literature, much of it classed as occult because it is not yet capable of scientific proof in the laboratory. A great deal of it built up of knowledge gained by those who have developed and trained some of the very powers that we have been discussing today, particularly clairvoyance, which has enabled the unseen worlds of nature and the unseen bodies of man to be investigated, examined, and understood. Though they have had to bear much ridicule, yes, and even calumny, much of what they have said is now being gradually corroborated by science, and the fact that such powers exist can no longer be denied. So far, only the fact of these powers has been tested to any extent. The result of the use of such powers, especially in highly developed persons, is still a long way from being fully investigated. There is no reason, however, why they should not be able to reveal to us knowledge concerning man and the unseen universe, which is equally as valid as that observed in the physical world. That does not mean that we should accept everything that is said by someone who may have only slight clairvoyance or other faculties as necessarily being completely correct, for it is subject to their interpretation, just as our knowledge of what we perceive in the physical world with our senses is limited by our own degree of our powers of observation and their accuracy. And sometimes their clairvoyance might be at a very low level, or some imagination may creep in. There have, however, been sufficient of those who have been trained, who have developed their powers, who have corroborated their observations, so that a body of knowledge which has the ring of authenticity has been built up, and upon this we can draw. Now, the theosophical view of man is that he is a spiritual being, a spark of the one divine flame, clothed in bodies of flesh and feeling and thought, which are the threefold aspects of his personality. Through many incarnations, as his evolution progresses, he gradually brings into full play the divine potentialities and all the faculties which are latent within him, which he is able to exercise intelligently and for unselfish purposes. Just as mankind has already developed the five senses as we know them, so it is postulated that two further faculties of perception will be awakened, those of clairvoyance and clairaudience, literally clear seeing and clear hearing. Through these faculties, he will have contact with the subtler worlds around him, of which at the moment he is unaware. Some people have already begun to have experience of these faculties, though not yet to a very great extent. And because they are not generally awakened in mankind as yet, while still considered by many to be abnormal and to be products of the imagination. You'll remember that Joan of Arc was one who claimed to hear voices, was apparently clairaudient, and she was burnt at the stake as a heretic. C.W. Leadbeater, himself a highly trained seer, says that clairvoyance and clairaudience, like so many other things in nature, are mainly a question of vibrations, and are in fact only an extension of powers which we're all using every day in our lives. He gives us a very useful example to help us to understand this. He says, if anyone will take a good prism and by its means throw a clear spectrum on a sheet of white paper, and then get a number of people to mark upon the paper the extreme limits of the spectrum as it appears to them, he is certain to find that their powers of vision differ appreciably. Some will see the vase extending much further than the majority do. Others will perhaps see rather less violet than most, while gaining a corresponding extension of vision at the red end. Some few there will perhaps be who can see further than ordinary at both ends, and these will almost certainly be what we call sensitive people. In hearing, the same difference can be tested by taking some sound which is just not too high to be inaudible, and discovering how many among a given number of people are able to hear it. These examples show then that there is no hard and fast limit to man's power of response, either to etheric or aerial vibrations. It's not difficult to imagine then, as Mr. Leadbeater points out, that it might be possible for man to develop this power, and thus in time to see much that is invisible to his fellow men, and to hear much that is inaudible to them. It is not then difficult for us to conceive the possibility of a steady and progressive extension of our senses. To go into the subject a little more technically, though by no means completely, according to occult research by those who have developed these powers which we are discussing today, every man has rudimentary organs of perception and of action at the subtle levels, and it is through these that psychic experiences occur. Furthermore, it is said that there is a subtle counterpart of all dense physical forms, which is called etheric matter. It is through the densifying of etheric matter that manifestations at seances usually occur. The etheric matter around the human physical body is termed the etheric body or bubble in man, and its matter is woven delicately in and out of every cell and organ of the physical, and is so subtle that it responds to stimuli from the inner world, reflecting impulses of thought and feeling through the etheric material surrounding the brain and nervous systems, and especially through certain etheric vortices called chakras that are active near to the ductless glands. Thus, man's etheric bubble acts as a bridge between his inner subtle bodies and his outer dense physical form. In most people at present, there is a fine veil, it is said, of the subtlest etheric matter, which shuts out psychic visions, but allows the registration of feelings and thoughts. Sometimes, however, it is loosely knit, and this gives rise to involuntary psychism. Sometimes it is damaged through shock, extreme fatigue, the use of certain drugs, in the case of delirium tremens, or through the wrong use of hypnosis or ignorant psychic practices, and gives rise to a great deal of usually unpleasant and even dangerous psychic experiences which cannot easily be shut off. These faculties appear to a limited extent among primitive peoples, but tend to disappear again with the development of concrete minds, appearing again in a more developed form in the course of evolution. As evolution proceeds, it is said, areas of the etheric veil will become naturally sensitized and so permit impressions from the inner world to register in physical consciousness. By this time, the inner bodies of thought and feeling will be coming under the control of the spiritual man, and his personal life will be harmonized and coordinated so that the doors between the inner and the outer world may be opened. The vortices of four centers known as chakras, which I have already mentioned, will be vivified by the awakening of a vital force in the body known in the East as Kundalini, or serpent fire, and thus bring into physical consciousness experiences in the subtler realms of being. Clairvoyant perception may arise at different levels. At the physical, man may have X-ray vision or magnifying or telescopic vision. If he is only slightly clairvoyant, he may be seeing etheric matter, which is only slightly less dense than the physical. Or it may be on a subtler level, which is usually termed the astral, and which is the world of feeling and emotion, and is where our consciousness is centered, usually when we are asleep or when we pass over after death. A more developed clairvoyant may be seeing the finer matter of the thought world. On each of these planes of manifestation, the physical body, so it is said, has its counterpart through which the consciousness functions, though we are aware of them down here simply as emotions or as mind. As the percipient develops, the faculty of clairvoyance may include the ability to see scenes or events distances away, or relating to the past or to the future. Thus we see that most of the different types of phenomena which we have discussed in this study resolve themselves into some aspect of clairvoyance to a greater or lesser degree. Now here it is important to emphasize that whilst we can regard any manifestations of these powers which occur spontaneously in people as normal and should try and understand their function, we should be very careful about in any way trying to force their development without the proper knowledge or direction. Otherwise we might do serious harm. If there is a teacher available who has this knowledge, then the harm is minimized. Some people, without correct guidance, have tried to force the unfoldment of psychic powers and have damaged the etheric veil, so that they have not been able to control the resultant manifestations and they have finished up in the mental asylum. Now, in discussing this subject, details concerning the mechanism of the power in man have been touched upon only briefly. There is a great deal of information and literature available, and those students who are interested can go on from here. My main purpose is to indicate that man is a very complex being, and he is still far from manifesting his full potentialities. Just as the acorn has all the possibilities of the oak tree which it will one day become, so man, the microcosm, has all the attributes of the macrocosm of which he is a reflection. In most people, the godlike powers are still sleeping and will awaken as their evolution progresses. From a practical viewpoint, the study of theosophy reveals that there are two very potent powers in man of which most of us are not fully aware, and yet are of the greatest importance to us today. These are the powers of our own emotions and thoughts. When we are exercising these faculties, we are creating, according to occult research, depending on their strength, actual forms which take shape and are installed for a time by a certain elemental life. And these forms can affect other people for good or for evil. The experiments in telepathy to which I have referred are sufficient to indicate how it is possible to influence the mind of another or to be influenced. And when our thought and emotions are strongly charged, they can be very potent. Thus, if our thoughts are filled with greed, hate, lust, avarice, anger or malice, they can have a real effect on those around us, and especially on those to whom our thoughts may be directed, whether such direction be conscious or unconscious on our part. Conversely, if we direct our thoughts of love, health and strength to others, they can be a very tangible power for good. All the time in our daily lives, we are constantly exercising this power to some extent, as our thoughts, often charged with emotion, radiate out into the ether, and as our minds are passive or negative and are influenced by the thoughts of others. It's also being recognized by medicine that both our emotions and thoughts can have a very real influence over our own health, both psychological and physical, and these must be very often taken into account in the treatment of disease. Thus we begin to see that in the study of man's nature, we find that the powers of the personality are very real and active. And once we realize their potency, we become aware of the deep responsibility that is ours simply in exercising our own thoughts and emotions. By endeavoring to harmonize them, we are not only beginning to purify the personality, but are making of ourselves centers for the radiation of harmonizing influence around us. That is why this information is of such deep practical value to each one of us. And above all, we must never forget that much more important than the appearance of or cultivation of latent psychic faculties is that of spiritual development, which is of a higher order than psychism. What we most need in the world today to solve the great problems facing humanity is the unfoldment of spiritual powers, the expansion of consciousness in each man beyond the emotions and mind to higher, abstract, inspirational, intuitional, and spiritual levels of being, so that we can bring true understanding, vision, and wisdom into our lives and in our relationships with others. There is a saying attributed to Ansari of Herat which goes, "Can you walk on water? You've done no better than a straw. Can you fly in the air? You've done no better than a blue bottle. Conquer your heart, then you may become somebody." The emphasis then in the true spiritual life is particularly on the path of expanding consciousness by treading the path of self-realization, turning the mind back upon itself, withdrawing into the stillness of the heart and beginning to touch the world of reality, stepping on to the threshold of abstract thought and gaining a vision of the world which lies beyond, where all barriers of self-separateness disappear. This is the way taught by all great teachers, to seek the Christ spirit within and bring the powers of that spirit into our lives. Those are the true latent powers, the potentialities of the divine spark that burns within, that we can, through our own seeking and effort, fan into flame.
Miss Zahara, I'm sure that I voiced the sentiments of the audience this morning when I say that we have listened to a fine historical survey of the powers latent in man. And not only that, we have been thrilled with the possibilities that lie before us, one and all. The intellectual discussion, which was given to us so splendidly, was followed afterwards by an idealistic but practical survey of the responsibility that lies upon humanity for these powers. It is, in reality, of great interest to us to have had displayed to us the possibilities of what I am going to call white magic. You must have realized, even before Miss Zahara came to the splendid end, the splendid conclusion of her remarks, you must have realized, with that mystery of precognition, that what we are discovering is man's unity with the soul of the universe. We are divine in origin. This brings to us the heavy but sweet burden of the knowledge that what we can do will be for the helping, the betterment, and the furtherance of spiritual ideals for the changing of the world. To me, it is that practical insistence upon the idealism that is necessary in the world of man that has been peculiarly fascinating in the lecture to which we have listened this morning. Ms. Zahara, I offer you our grateful appreciation of the work you have done.